Welcome to episode number 90 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we'll be bringing in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I am the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
Our guest today is game designer and Sierra Online co-founder Roberta Williams. Roberta is the original creator and designer of the King's Quest and Phantasmagoria series, among others, and was the recent recipient of the Pioneer Award at the Game Developers Choice Awards. Roberta, thank you for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
So what I didn't mention in that cold intro is that Roberta is also the author of an upcoming game, Colossal Cave 3D Adventure, a reimagining of a game that many would call the originator of the entire adventure game genre. And Roberta's actually here to tell us about that game today and how it inspired her own work. So, Roberta, just to start us off, set the scene for us. Who was Roberta Williams before she discovered this game?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I was just recently asked something along those lines not too long ago, like last week, I think. What would I have done, or who would I be, or what would I be doing if I had never discovered this game? And I said, wow, that's really interesting. Nobody's ever asked me that. And I had to stop and think for a minute because it is very true that this game is what started my career. It started Sierra Online and Ken's career. And arguably, you could say that it actually started at least the adventure game genre of adventure games. And I wasn't the first, actually, to learn from this game and to develop my career, you might want to say, from this game. Actually, after playing this game myself in 1980, I finished it. I found it on the, I didn't find it, Ken found it. He was doing some contract programming for Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, California. And as a contract programmer, he had a real job, a programming job during the day, and this was a contract job for the hospital. And they had a big mainframe computer that he was working in, and he was working on what you call a teletype machine, which was kind of like a big modem to a certain extent that would hook into the mainframe at Children's Hospital.
And, okay, so we had a terminal in your home?
It was a teletype machine. Yeah, it was like a terminal or modem. It was kind of both. You take your telephone, and it had like two foam cups that were just, you know, if you think in the 1980. That most telephones still, you put it up to your ear and your mouth, and you had two, you know, things there, and it would fit those two. I don't even know what you call them anymore. You know, earpieces and mouthpieces would fit into these foam cups, and then you would dial in a number, and the teletype machine has a keyboard, and then it has that little modem thing that you put your phone in. And then, and it had a roll of paper that was attached to it. Imagine like a very large calculator looking thing that, you know, calculators, we know we have a roll of paper. So this was, but it was much bigger. The roll of paper was probably 11 inches wide and you could type into it. And so it was talking to the mainframe computer in Children's Hospital through the telephone lines. And so you could type into it, but the feedback was through paper that would just print out. So Ken is working on a teletype machine to do, so he could get into the computer at Children's Hospital and do his work. But he got into the, one of the server sides of the, it was an IBM, probably it was a 360 mainframe. And just to see what was in, you know, in the game server, they had like a server and found several games in there. And one of them was this game called Adventure. And he showed it to me. at home, and he says, you got to see it. It's like playing a story. And I sat down, and he said, oh, you just have to type in one or two words to talk to it, and it'll respond back to you. And it's like going through a story. It's an adventure you can explore and everything. And so I started typing in one and two word sentences and immediately got drawn into the story of this game. And to the point where I just kept wanting to play it all the time. And I would get stuck, in various places, puzzles and things like that. And I remember going to bed and thinking about it and like, oh, how do I get past the dragon? And I don't mind bringing that up because it's very famous. And I just can't do it. And I want to go on. I know there's another passage behind him and I can't get to it. So, I was so very obsessed by it and, finally solved it and, got the maximum points in this game. A lot of it is about points that you get. Some are taken away from you if you do the wrong things. And then you're given points, obviously, for doing the right things. And the best players get 350 points maximum. That's the best. And I wanted to do that. And I did. It took me probably a month or more to do it. And then once it was done, I wanted to play more like it. But, we discovered that there was another company called Adventure International. And the man that was running it and was their designer and programmer and everything was a man by the name of Scott Adams. Not was, he's an is still, but his name is Scott Adams, but not the one we normally think of.
Right.
He had developed some of these games. One was called Adventureland, and I think another one was Pirate Adventure, and I think he had one that was based on Dracula, and they were all little text adventure games. And I started playing them, and though they were good, they weren't Colossal Cave or Adventure. They were good, but they were not that good. but I have to say, in defense of Scott Adams, that honestly, with actual design, I'm not sure any of my games. I don't think any of my games are as good as of a design as this one. To me, this design is probably the best. It was the first. It was a progenitor of adventure games. And they invented and started out the ideas of many ideas that we all now use when we're designing adventure games came from this game. Mazes and timing in many, many ways, countdowns, ticking up things that you're doing, lamp light, for instance, how much lamp light you have is per turn, but it begins to dim before it goes out, and all of this is counted. It has all these counters in it. To keep things real current with you as you're going through the game and you feel you're all constantly in the present and that there somebody's watching you, that you're being watched. That's one thing about this game. You constantly feel like you're not alone. You're being watched and your score as it gets higher and then it gets lower and different things happen in this game. Is one of the things that helps move along that feeling. So there was a lot of levels and layers to it. It's story-like, exploration. They thought of the idea of having inventory objects that you could pick up and carry and use. They thought that up. So I guess what I'm saying is that a lot of the elements that we use to design adventure games was started in this game. And so that's where I say, I think the design of this is so elegant and newsworthy and noteworthy and historical that I can honestly say, I don't think even any of my designs are up to snuff on this as this one. And so, and as wonderful as Scott Adams' game was, it wasn't either. And I kept saying to myself and to Ken, I want to play a game like this, but this isn't it. And I can't be the only one that wants to play this kind of game. And that's what caused me to sit down and design my first game, Mystery House, because I was drawn to it. I've had passion for it. I just had to do it. And I couldn't really explain it.
Well, so before we get there, I'm curious, you know, when you sat down and Ken showed you Adventure for the first time. I mean, had you had computer experience before this? And in fact, I mean, did you play computer games even before Adventure?
Well, that's the funny thing. Well, you know, arcade games. In those days we did have the arcades where you could go and on the big machines. And I'm trying to think what was a game then. I mean, well, it was like Pong, you know, Atari, Breakout. I mean, there were probably Space Invaders maybe might have been around then. Maybe you probably know more than I do for, you know, on that. But in, you know, go to the game arcades, you know, and put your money in and play or shoot ducks or something with your, you know, with your little gun or something. But that was about it. And then there's, of course, pinball and all those kind of things. But as far as a computer game, there weren't really any real computer games there. That was most computer games that you would find in those days. Because remember, the personal computer was just barely getting started. The TRS-80 and then the Apple II, Apple I, not so much, but we're just barely going into the homes. And so the computer games then were things like Adventure or Colossal Cave that at the time, 1980, was published by Apple. They had their own version of this game, and it was called Apple Adventure, and by Microsoft. And Microsoft also had it, and it was Microsoft's Adventure.
Well, I find it kind of funny that, you know, there were actual microcomputers at the time that one could publish software for and play in. But your first exposure was actually, you know, even by 1980, maybe a little odd, right? In that you have it wasn't common to have a teletype machine in the house, right?
Well, we didn't have a microcomputer. That's funny to be called a microcomputer. We didn't have one. We got our first personal computer, microcomputer, Christmas of 79. And so I had started playing it probably right at the beginning of December on the teletype machine, because that's the way Ken was working at home to work with the Children's Hospital, probably accounting software or something like that. And it just happened to be on their mainframe, and we just happened to, you know, so I started playing it on the teletype machine, but as soon as we got our Apple II, I got Apple's Adventure and started playing it there. So I did transfer over to playing it and finishing the game on the Apple II. I was really happy to get away from the teletype machine. So, So it was odd to start it, but it is the truth. You ask, and that's the way it was.
Yeah, I guess. You know, maybe sort of take us into, you know, that experience. We know that it's a roll of paper. We know that it's, you know, you type in commands and then the teletype sort of types back to you the response. I mean, how slow are we talking? And does that slowness almost, you know, contribute to the feel of the game that made it compelling for you?
You know, it was pretty fast because we were dialed into a mainframe computer, you know, a big computer. So it actually was, I mean, it was over the telephone lines, but I don't remember having to sit there and, you know, tap my fingers, you know, on the table, you know, waiting for it. I don't remember that, but I do remember the minute we got our Apple II, and we actually didn't wait until Christmas Day to open up the box. You know, it was probably, might have even only been like a week or so after the Teletubbies, you know, the experience doing that. Maybe because I wanted to, I mean, you mean I could play this game on the Apple II? Well, let's go ahead and get it then. Okay. So it was, it could have been even something like that. But you ask if I had any computer experience before. And yeah, minutely maybe. Well, maybe a little more than minutely, but I did. I had some training on IBM 360s to operate them. And so I did have a job operating IBM 360 mainframe in Illinois. We lived in California, and we moved back to Springfield, Illinois for winter, the worst time to go there from California. But we moved back because Ken got a job with the state, I guess, government, which is in Springfield. That's the capital of Illinois. It's not Chicago. And so we moved there to Springfield, Illinois. And Ken, one day, we had just moved there, and he said, you know, you should really get a job. We had a 2-year-old, and I said, doing what? I mean, I had had jobs before, but not necessarily on a computer. He said, well, I just noticed there's this opening for an IBM 360 computer operator for Springfield Junior, it's called Lincoln Land Junior College. And I said, you want me to get a job operating IBM 360 computers? He says, you know how to do it. And I said, well, sort of. And the reason why I sort of knew how to do it was when Ken was learning how to be a programmer, he went to a school, I guess it would be a technical college, called Control Data Institute. It was back in the day. I don't know if they exist anymore, but back then in 1979, it was before then. No, it would have been mid-70s. They were teaching people how to program computers, which at the time were on the IBM 360, a very popular mainframe computer back then for many corporations. And so he was going to Control Data Institute while working another job. And so at night, in the middle of the night even, we would go to their computer, their operate, you know, where the IBM mainframe is for the Control Data Institute. And so he could practice his programming, and it was on cards. So you have a card reader. And so he would go there and is doing his work for Control Data Institute learning. And he was telling me to go and turn on this machine, turn it on and put the cards in the card reader and press this button. And change the tape. It was looked kind of a big round, might have been 12-inch diameter, like not cassette tape, but tape.
Like reel-to-reel tape, yeah.
It was like reel-to-reel tape. And change it, you know, take off the old one, put on the new one, and or even hard drives to change the hard drive. And that was like a round, heavy-ish kind of thing. It was maybe round, like, again, maybe about 11 inches in diameter, but it was deep. It looked like it had almost like records or something under it that would just go down and spiral down sort of with a handle on top. And it was probably at least a pound or so to lift up and go lift it up and then lift out the old one, set it and put in the new one and put it in, press another button. So while he was busy learning in the middle of the night, I would be helping him I would just operate the computer. He says, you know, I'm too busy. I'm doing this. Go do that. Well, I don't know how to do that. We'll pick, you know, the button and do this and do that. And so I did that for quite a long time and got used to it. And he said, well, you know how to do it. It's the same machine. You've done that before. And I said, well, yeah, but that was several years ago. I don't know that I remember it. And I wasn't really working. I was just doing that. It wasn't that hard. And he said, well, that's what it is. Well, you do. And I said, really? So I actually went and I interviewed for that job and got it, which, you know, I was like, okay, all right. And,
you know, I mean, I can imagine they're like, wait, you've touched one of these before? Yeah. You're hired.
This brand, not a lot.
Well, I was, you know, but it seemed odd to me because I figured, you know, it'd be a lot of guys, you know, would show up for that job. And here I was, I mean, I was probably about 22 years old. And I had, the only work experience I had had up to that point was as a typist clerk for the County of Los Angeles in their welfare department in the city of Pomona, California, and, you know, typing and filing. And that was the only work I actually had done. And so I thought it was odd, you know, I walk in and to talk to the programming manager for Lincoln Land Junior College, 22 years old, and I'm small, you know, and very petite. And, you know, and I always had kind of a high voice. And when I was 22, I looked 12, you know, maybe 14.
I can relate.
And, you know, and so I just went in real blasé, like, because I didn't really want the job anyway. So I just went in and I, oh yeah, I could do that. You know, of course I know how to do that. And I got the job. And I have my thoughts as to why, but I won't get into that. But anyway, I did get the job and it was easy. We didn't like Illinois. It was too cold. I wanted to go back to California. That's my, I don't know if you can hear her.
We can.
That's the Klee-Kai. You asked. Hey, you can't. You have to go. I know you're going to edit this out. So,
are we?
Maybe not. Okay. Well, if she does it again, I may have to call in Ken to come get her. So, yeah. And anyway, we moved back to California. We could not stand the cold of Illinois in the winter. And I got another job for the County of Los Angeles to to do the same thing, to operate an IBM 360 mainframe for the County of Los Angeles. And I did that for about 6 months. And then my final job in the computer industry was I did get a job as a trainee programmer in COBOL for Lowry's Foods in also in the Los Angeles area. And I did that for probably 6 months and didn't like it. And by then I had my second child and I was just, you know, didn't have a job at that point and started playing this game. And I guess I picked out my own career with playing this game.
Well, so, you know, that sort of explains how you got to the computer, but I'm wondering, you know, did you have any sort of like storytelling background or ambitions before this?
Yeah, this harkens back to the question or the subject you sort of brought up before is what would Roberta Williams have been if I had not played Colossal Cave and started the career of adventure game design that I did. And the answer is that I've always been into storytelling. And when I was a kid, I was a real bookworm. My mom, and this is in the days of libraries, that you actually went to a library to get.
Oh, we still have those, but.
But you don't need to now. We've right. got Amazon and we've got Kindles and everything else. But in those days, you actually had to, you know, basically. or unless your parents bought you the books. And my, actually my parents bought me a lot of books, but my mom was constantly taking me to the library, and I'd be, you know, coming back with however many books they would allow me to take out. And I would read them within a couple of days. I mean, I would read them in a day if I could, except my mom kept chasing me outside. But then I'd go back and then get more and go back and get more. But I was a real bookworm, and I mean, I just couldn't get enough of stories. And I, to this day, I have cousins and my brother, friends who I knew as children, you know, we were children, would say, still say to me today that they remember me as constantly telling them stories, and these wild stories sometimes. And to the point of, I had one of my cousins, a male cousin of mine, just a few months ago told me that he was very, very afraid of some of the stories I would tell him, that I would convince them, you know, that, I don't know, that I was traveling to the moon, or, you know, aliens, or my brother, I used to tell him at night, I used to go to Candyland because I loved that game when I was a kid, you know, Candyland, and I would imagine it. And I would tell my brother what Candyland was like and all the things that I did there. And he would be entranced by what I was telling him. So yeah, I guess you could say I have natural storytelling abilities. And so I might have wound up writing children's books, or who knows, something like that.
What kind of works did you like to read? I mean, it was obviously, you know, your first couple of games, I guess genre-wise, you've kind of done everything at this point, but, you know, probably most known for the fantasy stuff. Was it a lot of fantasy books, or was it all over the place?
Well, I think when I was a kid, my favorite types of, well, fairy tales was, it went probably starting from when I was in second grade to maybe fifth grade. I was really into, maybe fourth grade. I was really into fairy tales. And I read every fairy tale book you could throw at me. I mean, it's just fairy tales, and then reread them. You know, one of the things about kids is they reread again and again and again. And so I had a lot of experience with that. And but then as I got older, I evolved to more adventure type stories, Robinson Crusoe. I guess Alice in Wonderland, that's very fantasy. It's not exactly a fairy tale, but it is, it's definitely fantasy and an adventure. It's definitely an adventure. And The Wizard of Oz, and anything. I kind of also got into pioneers, you know, pioneers going across the country in their covered wagons, you know. Anything that was exploratory, I think, where people were put into odd situations and had to survive or learn how to live or get out of there. How do they escape? How do they get back? Any kind of stories like that, I was always drawn to. And so that's another element. And then as I got even older and into high school, and older than that, and still to this day, I got more and more into history, and became a real history buff. And to this day, I would say the reading material that I really prefer is history, historical novels, and things like that. So that's my evolving reading interests, I guess.
So this might be hard to think back to, but I'm just wondering, you know, the first time you're playing adventure, is there this feeling of like, wait, computers can do this?
when it was first evolving.
Well, it's just like the first time you sat down and it's like a computer is telling you a story.
Oh, yeah. Because, well, you could see that I was very involved with books and stories. And I think when you're a child or a young person and you're reading a story, and especially if it's very adventurous kind of story, you kind of think, wouldn't it be great if I could control it? If I, you know, the main player, the main protagonist is going over here and doing all this, but what if I wanted to go over there? The writer mentioned the mysterious garage on the property, you know, and yet they never go over there. You know, why can't I go there?
Go to garage.
What's in there? You know, what's in there? They keep mentioning it, but they don't ever seem to get over there. And so I think people, if you're really into books and stories, sometimes would think that, wouldn't it be great if I could just decide where I want to go and sort of be the lead player, you know, or protagonist in this story. Maybe in the back of your mind, you have that. Mm-hmm. And so when I started playing Colossal Cave, it was called Adventure in those days, but since it's taken on the name of Colossal Cave, when I first experienced it, that I had that instant feedback of it talking to me and telling me where I was, but giving me options where I could go and what I could do. And then when I found out I could actually get an object and pick it up and have it, and I'm carrying it with me wherever I go, and then you start thinking, wow, I actually got an object, you know, that probably means, and the first thing I got was a set of keys. And then you think, oh, a set of keys. That must mean there's something to unlock somewhere. I wonder what it is, you know, and it doesn't take much to get you going when you have things like that.
So, you know, I'm realizing we haven't really talked about what is this game like to play? What is sort of a little slice of playing adventure? Can you describe the game for us?
Yeah, I mean, it is. And before I really get into that, I have to say that I have not played this game for probably 40 years.
Okay.
I hate to say, you know, you guys are vastly younger than that, but that's the truth. So,
she thinks I'm younger than 40. That's so cool.
Sort of forgot some of it, not all of it, but enough of
it. You're remaking it. How?
Remaking it. And so, you know, I just remembered the exhilaration of playing it and my obsession with it. And it just popped in my head that Ken and I should do it and see if we could get those juices started again, you know, of designing a game, and could we really get back into the industry? And so I remember thinking, God, this will be pretty easy because it's already designed. I don't have to design it. And by the way, I should take this juncture to mention who the actual designers are, because mm-hmm. that's so important. It's not really my game. It is true. I am reimagining it and I am translating it to modern times, but the actual designers of this game, it was started initially by a spelunker. That means a cave explorer named Will Crowther, and actually Will Crowther and his wife, and I don't remember her name, I hate to say. Later, and he worked for MIT. No, I think he was going, to school at MIT as an engineer. And he was developing it on MIT's computers. And it was an experiment with AI, artificial intelligence. And that's in his mind how it got started. That was Will Crowther. And it was put on their computers, and as people left MIT, they took it with them, and they took them to other colleges, universities, and to corporations as they got jobs. And that's how it got spread. And that's how Children's Hospital had it on their computers. But later on, maybe a year or two or three later, Don Woods, he came along, he played it. I don't remember where he found it. I should know that these things a little better than I do. But he played the game, but he thought that it was a really good start, but that he could add to it and make it better. And so he added probably half of what is now Colossal Cave to it. So you could say that half of it Will Crowther designed and half of it Don Woods designed. And so together they're the two designers, and I want them to have the credit. So it's not my game, but I am reimagining it.
Have you met either of them?
I have not. Ken talked to Don Woods on the phone. When I had the idea with Ken to see if we could put graphics to it and bring it to people, game players of today, or even oldsters who played it a long time ago, might be interested in playing it as a graphics game. And he found Don Wood's phone number. He couldn't find Will Crowther's, and he just called him up and explained who he was. And I don't know if Don Woods actually knew who we were, you know, or anything like that.
Yeah, but he wasn't like the Ken Williams, right?
No,
he's not someone who stayed in the computer industry.
I don't think he really stayed in the computer industry. I mean, I think he did some programming, but I don't think he never did in another game. I know he went on and he was a computer or a software engineer doing, I don't know what, but I think more businessy or, you know, something like that, but definitely not games. So I'm not so sure that he actually knew who Ken was. He was just a guy that called and was interested in remaking his game. But since then we have heard that there's been about 180. In fact, I think that's the number that Ken found in a search on the internet. 180 different iterations of Colossal Cave have been done by people over the years, almost all of them text. Many people have added to it, added their own puzzles, added more exploration, added more points, you know, added more. Zork is a good example from Infocom. Zork was based upon Colossal Cave. And it's not Colossal Cave, but it's a lot of it is Colossal Cave, maybe by different names and different situations, but it kind of is. So, and a few graphic games have been done with it, but just very simple and years and years and years ago and not that great. So I think Ken was just another person calling and saying, can I do your game? Would you mind? And he said,
I wonder how many of those 180 like actually got permission too. Like that's, I feel like that's kind of, I don't know that anyone owns it per se.
Nobody owns it.
So to get permission, I think is a nice thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, we didn't know. Well, Ken didn't know. And that was the other reason why he wanted to talk to him, because we didn't know. I mean, theoretically, I guess we could have just started doing it, but that seemed wrong. And especially being us, because we wanted to do it right and make, you know, really do it right. And we, because we have the experience, we could do that. And we wouldn't want to put the time and the effort and the money into it. We're paying for it ourselves without having permission. If you're just a hobbyist and you're just tinkering around and you put it out there, that's one thing. You probably don't need to call or really get permission, but we're trying to be more professional about this. And so he did. And Don Woods said, well, that's fine. No, we don't own it. But what we do is we ask people to please, you have our approval, you know, our personal approval, but we ask that you not try to make it your, in other words, to own it and not let other people do what they wish with it. And we said, okay. And after having worked on this game, I think it'll be probably quite a bit longer before anybody is going to want to try to tackle this project. It's turned out to be a huge, because I forgot how big and complex this game really is. What I did is I said to Ken, and I thought it was going to be a smaller, easier game. And when I said to him, I want to go back to the original game. I know that many people have added stuff over the years. And I played the original 350-point game. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go back to the beginning, kind of like coming to a full circle. You know, mm-hmm. Start with Colossal Cave. I don't necessarily want to say end with Colossal Cave, but kind of come back to it and also to honor it. For me, it's an honor to do this. And also, it's sort of emotional for me, and I'm very close to it, because without it, I wouldn't have had the wonderful career that I had. And I feel like I owe Colossal Cave this to a very great extent.
Well, and that's really similar to what I was about to ask, which is, you know, now that you're in remaking this game, I have to imagine you are sort of inhabiting this game again, maybe mm-hmm. for the first time since 1980, right? And you know, this might be a little fluffy or philosophical, but I'm just kind of wondering, like, now that you're sort of living it again, is it like going back to an old movie or an old book where you're like appreciating new things about it that you couldn't have understood back in 1980?
Big time. Very much appreciating it. And it's bringing back lots of memories of the game, because I'll say, I completely forgot about that. Oh, I remember. Oh, that's so fun. You know, forgot about a lot of it, but immediately remembered. But the thing is that I also have been very surprised by how deep it is, how complex it is, how many layers it has. All of the, I don't know the word, the word invention is not the right word. The, precepts of, is that the good word, precepts of adventure game design, just about every type of obstacle or even puzzles and timing. And I mean, just like I said before, are in this game and invented and put into this game. And there's almost nothing that have been done in adventure games.
I was about to say, I might have imposter syndrome if I play this.
There's almost nothing that's been put in adventure games since that wasn't already in this game. And as I have looked into it deeper and deeper, I see these things. And like, wow, these guys were really prescient and innovators and inventors. I mean, they just really came up with something really special. And that has been kind of revelatory to me. And the other thing is that we have, this has been really cool, is because I said that I wanted to go back to the original game. The original, the most oldest, most original source that we could find.
And so to be clear, is this the literal first one, that the Crowther one without...
Well, the Crowther one didn't have the 350 points.
That's... Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the original, yeah, no. That's a good question. If you want to get very particular, the original is Will Crowther. And I don't think there was a point system. In fact, I'm pretty sure. Mm. I mean, I've sort of been steeped... I'm very steeped in the game right now, but not as much in the history. I've read the history. I've gone over it on the internet about them and how it all kind of started. But I don't, you know, I'm not, you know, remembering particularly every facet. but I don't think there was a point system with Will Crowther's version. I don't think so. And I think that was something that Don Woods added. So along with other things. So I said, I want the original source. And we did, we found on the internet, you know, find everything on the internet anymore. So we found the original Fortran that they use. So I actually go through almost every day, I go to their Fortran program, you know, and go through it, you know, page after page of it, you know, looking for answers to the design. And the nice thing about it is that their Fortran that we have is broken down into sections, and added to it are the designers' opinions and comments mm-hmm. and discussion about why they put this in, why they did it that way or this way. Because a lot of the people that we have, 27 people working with us on our team now. It's really big.
Wait, wasn't Sierra 30 people at some point?
I don't know. All this a very big team, you know, along the lines of the kind of teams that we had at the end of Sierra.
Yeah. Well, and you know, like you said, this was a small project you wanted to start with, yeah. Ken, originally. And so for it to be 27 people is probably maybe
not
a little...
Not including Ken and I, so yeah. That would be like 29 people. So the reason I brought up how many people are on the team, and most of them are about your guys' age. And I think one of them had played it as a text game, maybe two. But we've insisted that, you know, they all play it. So Ken has been giving him the link to the, you know, to the text game that we're using as our example game, and telling him to play it, you know, play the text game at least as much as you can. You know, they're using walkthroughs and things like that to get through it. But it was important that they have an understanding of what they're getting into. But in translating it over to graphics, we have graphics animation, characters to design, and sound and music, and just, you know, making it a really, really good game. They would say to me at the beginning, they don't argue with me anymore, but at the beginning they would say, well, I just think, you know, this might be too hard, or this is too easy, or, well, I just don't think it should, you know, that modern, they like to use the word today's, you know, players, or the modern players of today, they might not want it to be this way or that way. They're so used to games being a certain way. And I would explain to them that I know that, I understand that. I think a little bit was kind of like, well, you know, it's been a long time since you've been in the industry. It's been over 20 years, you know, and, you know, certain implications, you know, of which I understand. And then that was a long time ago. And you haven't even played this game in how many decades? And so I would say, believe me, I the things that I'm going to say to you is not because I don't understand what you're saying, or that I couldn't do a game today on my own, and who knows, I may, that would appeal to today's, you know, players, using you know, controllers in different ways, and, you know, even physicality. And of course, I understand that. But what I told them was that this game is a historical game. And we are taking a historical game that's very famous, and the design, as I've told you, is elegant. That's the one word I keep saying. It's just, to me, it is the perfect adventure game design. And to take that game, and it's been played by millions of people over 40 years, to take that game and try to make it so modern, you know, so, you know, all the whiz bang and the gravity and the physics and all, you know, and in VR and 3D, which we are doing, by the way, but to use and all the different techniques that we could be doing, it's not that I don't understand how to implement them or understand how they could be used. In fact, I look forward to maybe at some future game using those techniques. I could see a lot of fun with it, and I see a lot of things you could do, but I go back to this game, but this game does not feel, it doesn't feel right to me to do that. In fact, I felt like if I try to really take it forward so that it appeals to this very large group of video game players, many of them very young, I really honestly think that I could get pinged by reviewers and game players who did not imagine that this game would be like that and probably didn't want it to be like that. And that there are lots of people that I believe are going to play this game that aren't what you might call your typical computer or video game player of today, but they'll play it because they want to, because they remembered it, and it's a great game. Maybe I was part of it too, different reasons. But I would say to them, we're really balancing out how to do this, how to keep it what it is, but yet bring it to modern audiences and game players of today. And it's a real balancing act. And as our team have learned this game and gotten into this game, they know it as well as I do by this time. They have so much respect for it and love it. And it's funny now, because when I talk to them, about, they'll say, well, you know, this one thing, you know, about this might be, or no, I'll say, do you think this is too hard? This one maze or this one thing, you know, that maybe it's a little too hard for today's players. Maybe they don't want to do this or something. And now they say to me, no, I think it should be like the original. Yes, we should keep it like the original. And it's kind of funny how it's turned around.
I want to go back to this notion of being able to access the original Fortran source. So a big part of our mission at the foundation is that we believe that access to video game source material is beneficial, not just for recreating a game, but for the study of that game, for further understanding how games work, and even, you know, I can personally say in my experience, accessing source code for one of my favorite games of all time helped me to appreciate it in a way that I can't by just playing it. And I'm wondering if what I'm saying maybe echoes your experience actually looking at the original scripts for Colossal Cave Adventure.
Absolutely. And I mean, a lot of the reason why is because I'm a designer too. And I respect and love design, and especially really good design. I recognize a good design, and this is it. And so I have been amazed at the deep thinking that they put into it and the strategic thinking that they put into it as I get deeper and deeper into it. And even though I've never met them, I don't know if I'll ever meet them or even talk to them. I don't even know what they'll actually think about our game when we bring it out. That would be really interesting to know. If you could ever get them, that would be great, you know, especially after
for his number. Yeah.
Especially after our game ships, you know, and like, what do they think about it? I hope it does well, but, no, it, I have a real respect for good design of a game, and I mean, especially an adventure game, but I also have a real good sense of design of any game. When we had Sierra, mostly it was Ken and I that would decide, because we didn't only develop our own games. We were also a publisher. So we published other people's games. And in fact, as Sierra grew, we published more and more people's games. We were definitely growing our company that way too, but
you were a very early Japanese importer. Like, you published in Fexter is just still kind of remarkable to look back on.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but also in France with the Cocktail Vision, which is kind of a weird name, but it's what, they named it. And all over the United States, and I think England, I think we did first. I remember going to Reading a lot for some reason, but anyway, but Ken and I personally looked at once he started really getting more, you know, Ken was sort of acquiring small development groups and development houses and bringing them in under the Sierra umbrella. And as it got bigger and bigger, I guess I got a little bit more away from all that, but you know, up until probably before we sold the company, I was very involved with Ken in picking out the games that we developed and played. And we also had a lot of people submitting their games to us to look at and decide what to publish or not, or develop into more of a game. And I was always there with Ken in deciding, because I could, even if it wasn't a game that I would personally play or design, it wasn't in my my wheelhouse, sort of speak, to take a sort of a boat analogy. But I could certainly understand and look at quality and design and know if we should be publishing this or developing this or not. And Ken would really listen to me on that. So I do have, I have a real good sense of what a good game is versus a not so good game. And I can tell almost instantly. So I don't know where that came from, but that's what I'm talking about.
We're discussing, you know, if you gained a new appreciation for this game by looking at its source code.
Yes, I did gain a new appreciation. Absolutely. Much more than I thought I would, by far.
And are you getting comments in there that sort of explain, like, here's why we're doing this, and that sort of giving you that appreciation in the source, I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, a lot. Because there are questions where, when we're developing this game with graphics, adding graphics is harder than I thought it would be, especially being 3D. I mean, and with Oculus and, you know, Quest 2 and the VR and you know, you look around, you know, it's here, it's behind you, it's up above, it's below, it's everywhere. And which is really nice, because I mean, especially in a cave, I mean, you just feel like you're in a cave, but that brings up a lot of questions about, well, you know, why would you, you know, why did they want to do a puzzle or an obstacle or whatever this way? And I would even ask that myself, because I would be reading through the source and I'm typing up a design document of my own to give to our developers, trying to break it down into easier, you know, I don't expect them to have to go through and read Fortran to understand it. So, break it down into a design document that they can use. Although more and more, all of us are going through the Fortran. I think we're all learning Fortran actually to understand it. But there have been times when I've been puzzled and wondering, why did they want to do it that way? you know, and it didn't quite make sense. But then when I would go through the source and I would look for their comments, and they're just all over the place, kind of almost like hidden. It's almost like going through an adventure game in and of itself to go through this Fortran language with all their comments to find that. And when I do, when I find something where I'm looking for the answer, I'll say, there it is. It's like, I found a treasure, you know, there it is. There's the answer I was looking for. That's why they did it. And so, yeah, that's definitely have a very, very much an appreciation. Yes.
I've also found that, cause I've worked in development a little bit as well. And in some cases, you know, on sort of like remakes or reimaginings, and a lot of times, you know, having those comments, I found helps me stay in the mindset of appreciating and of always having this North Star of what the original artist intent was. Right. So like you kind of get an appreciation. You tell me if you feel the same that knowing why decisions were made and sort of guiding your own reimagining toward what it is they were trying to convey.
Right. Right. And then, but then you kind of get into the quandary of, should I, in this particular instance, given the fact that we're doing the graphics and we're designing characters, there is some dialogue among the characters, not much, and I'm not adding very much to that, but you know. Do I want to do it the same way, exact same way they did it in this instance? And my inclination is yes, if you possibly can, because that's my goal, is to keep it as original as I possibly can. But there are just instances where I can't, because just the way we're developing this doesn't lend itself to that. In which case I have to think of an alternative way. And this is where their comments come in handy to understand why they made decisions in the way they did. And then if I can't do it the way they did it, how can I do it in a way that will give the same sense to the player that it's the way they did it?
You know, this sounds
satisfaction.
Yeah, this sounds remarkably similar to like the definition of localization when you're, you know, translating a game from Japanese into English or something. How you can try and get really close to exact translation, but there are some things where it's just got to be intent and feeling and not quite the literal translation.
Yep, that's true. That's true. It's like I said, it's a dance. It's a balance, you know, it's.
So my last question for you is, how creatively satisfying is working on something like this as opposed to writing an original story?
Boy, that's a great question. It is. Even though I'm not coming up with my own story, I'm actually finding this harder to do than doing my own story, you know, or my own game. Because when you do your own, you know where you're going with it and how you want it to be and how you want it to come out and feel. And you feel it because it's inside your brain. But I don't find, honestly, this is going to sound funny, but I don't know. Self-aggrandizing or something, but I don't find it that hard to come up with a story for a game and to do an adventure game. I honestly don't. I guess I must have a little natural inclination to do it, but this game, it's harder to take their game, especially one as complex as it. And complex, I don't mean it's hard, just so deep and full of things to do. To take their game and make it still be their game, but add all this stuff that is beautiful and fun to look at and hear and that kind of thing. But yet it's still their game. I find it challenging. That's the good word. I like challenges. So I don't know, creative, but it is creative too, though.
Well, Roberta, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us on the Video Game History Hour. We will have links to Colossal Cave 3D Adventure in the show notes. But for those listening, where can people keep up with you and the game on the internet?
Oh, ColossalCave3D.com. ColossalCave3D.com.
Easy stuff. All right. Thank you so much, Roberta.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunimune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.